And welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who's under imminent danger from a Benderellips warhead. Yes, all 500 of us. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
And it's that famous anagram lovers Doctor Who story, Time Lash.
You know, sometimes with the Doctor Who story, a whole heap of elements come together. And here, you know, there's the script, there's the direction, the costuming, the set design, the music, and the actors' performances all come together to make this really an utterly, utterly horrific example of mid-80s Doctor Who. There's not a single one of those elements that even reaches a minimal level of acceptability. And so for me, this is easily Colin Baker's worst story and one of the worst stories in Doctor Who history. Todd.
Okay. I've criticized a lot of 80s stories, and you know which ones I don't like. For all of those elements that you have mentioned, right? The script falls in upon itself, the costuming and the sets and various performances, some of which I quite like and some of which I think are just terrific. But I can sit here and I can actually laugh away at it and enjoy. I actually quite enjoy episode one. I think it completely collapses halfway through episode two. If you were doing a bottom 10 of Doctor Who, it probably would make my number 10 in that list, right?
It's like 10th from the bottom.
That's right, 10th from the bottom. But unlike other things that I've been bored through or enraged by, for me it's not the worst thing ever.
What do you think is going on here? Like, what do you think they're aiming for? It really is the most kind of generic set of space rebels in a bunch of space corridors.
Well, obviously they need, you know, this is the cheapy of the season, right? Yeah. So, but it's so underwritten. In that second episode, what is Eric Saber doing? Well, obviously he's off writing Revelation of the Daleks and not script editing the second episode of this in any way.
Doesn't he write the big padding scene in the middle of episode two?
And a phrase I don't use very often, I think this is possibly only the third time in the history of the podcast, in Eric Saber's defense, he did actually have to perform a ground-up rewrite on this to the dialogue. Because the writer, Glenn McCoy, had never written for Doctor Who before and has never written for Doctor Who again.
He did have a proper career. I mean, he did write for things.
He wrote for things like Angels and, I believe, Casualty. You know, he was an up-and-coming writer, and that's part of the reason that they got him in. The problem was, of course, you know, not being very experienced with Doctor Who. We've also had massive problems with the previous story in broadcast two stories ago in production, The Two Doctors, of course, which had a rejected script from an American writer, then a rejected script from Bob Holmes because of the location change. Eric Saywood, of course, in some way or another, wrote Attack of the Cybermen. Even when this script was completed, Pennant Roberts read it, and he didn't like the way the characters spoke. He said this is a completely alien planet, and apparently it was written in very human vernacular and metaphor and simile and that sort of thing. So Eric Saywood had to perform that ground-up rewrite while he was, well, before he went off to write Revelation, because to write Revelation, he actually had to finish his contract as script editor first.
Well, I mean, if you need the dialogue not to sound like anything an actual human being from Earth would say, Eric Saywood's the one to get.
I think one of the things that sums up this story for me is the fact that in one of those first sequences with the first Malin and his son-in-law, what's his name?
Micros.
And Malin Rennis. And they go into that cubicle thing.
Oh, the power room.
And he pulls off the power knob and then surreptitiously puts it back on, and you actually see this happening. How can the director not go, that's not acceptable?
Yeah.
Mm-mm. And a big problem I have with this is a lack of establishing shots. It's very hard to get a sense of place. Like, we get one establishing shot of the Citadel, but we have no sense of scale. You know, we don't know how big it is, aside from the fact that it's got 500 people in it. We know that. Thank you, Tylor or God, whatever your name is. We've got horrible two-syl names.
Oh, yeah, but that's the other thing. Everyone has, we had, you know, good names like Dastari and Chassini, and we're going to have, you know, Tarkus and Lilt and Tass and Beaker next week. This week they all have horrific two-syllable names. They're all Kendron and Vena and Micros and things. They're all sort of terrible. And there's a terrible scene early on where Micros and Vena are having an argument for no reason other than to explain the structure of this society to all the people at home. And I just can't possibly care about anyone on this planet. There are 500 people in these sort of terrible space corridors. Later on, when we learn that the Benderlips warhead is heading to Carfel, we learn that there are millions of lives at stake. But I think that's written by Eric Saywood much later. Mm. But I just don't care about them. They are the planet Zog. They're literally the Zog people being menaced by the Zog monster, and I just don't care. And there's really nothing here that we haven't seen done before a lot of times and done better. And I do feel that Glenn McCoy has a feeling that this is the sort of thing that Doctor Who does. It does Rebels in Space Corridors. And it's clear that the high concept that he wants to pin this on is the Time Lash, and it's called Time Lash, and there's some timey stuff. So when the Borad shoots someone, they age. You know, the Time Lash is this sort of fearsome thing. But the Time Lash looks like something in a light entertainment set, like something in a game show. And it's in no way impressive looking. It's got those sort of tinsel lights, the sort of crappy sequins all over it. People just fade into it and scream. You know, the lights go up like it's a special round on the weakest link. And that's what we're pinning it on. And that's the only thing that distinguishes this from anything else. And we've seen plenty of stories where the Doctor comes in and overthrows the government, but the government is interesting in an interesting way, or is a political satire in some way. But that's not what the show does anymore in this period. So, you know, what do we learn here? That dictatorships are bad? It's really so empty. And so there are bits that are charming, and there's one character in particular whom I like a great deal, even though I think he's a mistake in some ways.
And who is that?
I really like Herbert.
I adore Herbert.
Yeah.
Why couldn't we keep him on? He would have been a great companion.
Look, in his first sequences with the Doctor in that hut, and he's trying to like exercise him,
although he could do with that.
And then bash him with the book. Like, I actually find it really funny and adorable. And
I think he's charming, isn't he?
And in a bumbling sort of way, and he has a great relationship with the Doctor. And in that hideous padding scene in episode two, which Eric Saywood had to write because the episode was running under time, like Colin Baker's face when he looks at Herbert when Herbert's doing whatever, and I just burst out laughing. Even though like the scene is complete padding, there's something I like about Herbert, and I like the fact that he's revealed to be H.G. Wells and that sort of thing.
Well, that's the bit that I think is stupid, because he's nothing at all like H.G. Wells.
H.G. Wells was a socialist and a Huxleyist, you know. Of course, he had religion growing up in the time he grew up in, but he was not devoutly religious and certainly was not sort of conscious of devils and probably wasn't experimenting with Ouija boards. I don't believe he was ever even a teacher. He studied to be a teacher, but he never completed.
He was known as George, like he's at Herbert George Wells. He was called George. He had a northern accent, I think. You know, like he's really nothing like Herbert. And in a sense, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But if you're going to have a celebrity historical, and this is the second celebrity historical this season, and the first time we've ever had celebrity historicals, actually.
Well, since Marco Polo.
Yeah, that's true. So there's not very much point. In fact, I think that the point is that this lamentably bad Doctor Who story is the inspiration for the science fiction career of one of the great science fiction writers of all time, who borrows the name Vena and the Morlockses and stuff.
The Island of Dr. Moreau, Invisible Man.
Yeah. All of that stuff. And look, H.G. Wells was capable of some really incredible crap. If you've ever read In the Days of a Comet, which is just rubbish, but it has a political kind of socialist message.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that he was in any way inspired by this dreary runaround is really just kind of insulting. It's a missed opportunity, isn't it? The story could be political because it is about a rebellion against an oppressive government. And you've got this really incredibly political science fiction writer, but we get no politics in this story.
After what you just said, I find it quite funny that this crummy Doctor Who story actually ends up inspiring all of these works of literature. Like, I think there's something deliciously, well, just humorous in that. If I was to do this, can I just indulge me for a moment?
Yeah, sort of fantasy directing.
So somebody out there can do this for me. Right? So I'd have Mikos and the Mail-In about to go into the power room, have their scene, cut to the Doctor and Perry in the TARDIS. They know that the time tunnel thing's there and they're heading for, like, doomsday. Cut back to the Mail-In being taken to the Borad. Cut back to the Doctor and Perry in the TARDIS. Cut back to Mikos and Vina having a bit of a conversation to set the scene. Cut back to the Doctor and Perry in the TARDIS. Cut back to the Mail-In being killed and our good friend Paul Darrow taking over. Cut back to the Doctor and Perry in the TARDIS. Like, you know, little brief snippets. Yeah. Then cut back to Paul Darrow striding in and saying, you know, your father's dead, right? Yeah. Cut back to the Doctor and Mary in the TARDIS. Cut back to, you know, that pathetic person that pleads for
Gazak,
his people. I don't even know what the lines of dialogue are, but, you know, he pleads for his people. He gets shoved down the time lash. Doesn't it all hell break loose at that point? Or am I?
Yeah, and that's where Vina steals the amulet. Vina goes
through. Cut back to the Doctor and Mary in the TARDIS. Vina goes through, right? Cut back to Carfell, and then you cut to the TARDIS coming up the corridor.
Which is just so bad.
But then you cut to the Borad going, it appears the Doctor is making a return visit to Carfell. Cue opening title sequence. Or end of episode, right?
Yeah.
Right. So you're just doing a huge edit on all of those things. Yeah. Because in that first sequence of stuff, you see, like, bland corridors of that robot thing and people getting captured, and you don't care. Like, I think the girl's okay, the rebel.
She is. I think
Cats.
She's actually
quite good. Mm. Vina, I'm just going to say this. I absolutely adore her in this entire story, the fact that she's obviously on Xanax or something, except for that one sequence where she has to get up on a chair and stop the Borad from looking through his video monitor or whatever she does. But I really love her performance. It's just so wooden. I just love it, you know.
She's just constantly spaced out.
And then having Mikos going, you're just a figurehead. I love his little performance. Paul Darrow.
It's nearly acceptable.
Nicola looks fantastic, right?
Yeah, first proper decent outfit she's had.
I think the highlight scene for me, the highlight of the whole thing, which I just burst out laughing every time, is when Paul Darrow's character gets killed by the Borad and the skeleton drops to the floor, the skull goes thump, thump. It's a double bang on the floor. I remember this as a kid and I just burst out laughing, and I just wait for that moment every time. It is the moment I wait for.
His little sidekick, Kendron, might be one of the worst. I think he makes Leonard Sachs look like, you know, Robert De Niro, frankly.
I have been faithful to you.
Doesn't the Borad do away with him too?
Yes.
Yeah, look,
he's got this giant IMDb page. He's in a Bond film. Like, he's in Tomorrow Never Dies. He's in The Last King of Scotland. He's got a proper career. He looks like he is from the year 10 production of an Inspector Calls. He's so bad.
I love the fact that he's so bad and so feeble and so crap and meets that end. I just take perverse pleasure. That's what I take. Perverse pleasure in performances and things in this that I just think that's so crap, but I'm laughing with it and going with it.
Pennant Roberts was actually trying to get him into Doctor Who for ages. He was meant to be either Tomas or Caleb in The Face of Evil. He was meant to be one of the principal younger men. And I'm so glad we didn't get him, because Leslie Schofield and the really hot chap who plays Tomas, whose name I can't remember, they're perfect in those roles.
Yeah. He's not replacing Tomas ever.
Thank you. Or David Garfield. That was a really good looking cast. Can we go back there? Something I do love in this story, though, is the H.G. Wells references aren't hammered into your skull. They are subtle Easter eggs there for people who either know the works of H.G. Wells or, and this is possibly a bit ambitious, after they watch the story might go and read some H.G. Wells, which is very much in keeping with what Colin Baker wanted the program to be. He wanted it to inspire children to learn new words and new ideas. This, to me, feels like a 1960s story. This was another one I took Richard's advice and watched in black and white, and it really lifts it. Another way I look at this story to help me get through it is it's another example, and there's so much of it this season, of making it like a Shakespeare. So you have your principal cast. You have the Doctor, you have Perry, you have Tekka, the Borad, Herbert, and they're sort of the bigger characters, and everyone else fades into the background a little bit, literally in the case of some of their costumes. And Tekka's characterization, Paul Darrow's performance, is magnetic to watch.
I really hate it. I really, really hate it. I love it. People going over the top. I love Jackie Pierce last week. I thought she was glorious. He's horrible to watch.
And they lost so much studio time because they kept having to order retakes because he was putting in even more than that. But I really like
I think he's
like
sabotaging
him.
It.
Well, I do wonder that sometimes because famously, and we'll come back to this next week, this is sort of a two-part anecdote. Colin Baker played Baben the Butcher in an episode of Blake 7 in a very similar way to Paul Darrow playing Tekka here, but arguably better.
He's enjoyable in that episode.
Yeah. Well, I find Paul Darrow enjoyable here as well, but I do sometimes wonder if Paul Darrow is playing it like this because of the way Colin Baker came into his show to play that.
But I think that's an urban myth, and I think it's something that people have suggested and then he's played on. That's what I think. Yeah, I mean, yeah. The other thing is that, you know, he had an argument with John Nathan Turner about what he was doing.
Well, he wanted to be Richard III, I think.
Yeah, he literally wanted to have a hump.
But I do find it so hilarious when he goes like, we'll do a tour of the Citadel for your assistant, and then he has that plant and shoves that plant into the doctor's face or whatever. Like,
yeah.
There's little things like that I do like, but I do get the fact that it is such an over-the-top performance, you're either going to, I think you can't be in the grey area. You either really love it or you really don't, and I can understand exactly where you're coming from, but for me it's sort of like it's one thing that keeps me glued to the screen when there's other beige sets with beige people with, you know, things I don't really care about.
I actually think that Colin's visibly uncomfortable acting opposite him, and it could just be me reading into it, but I just think that Colin doesn't like it. When was this recorded in order?
No, it is the second last story recorded.
Yeah, it is the second last. Because suddenly Colin's kind of horrible, and again, I think it's Colin's studio problem. That first scene with Perry and all that stuff in the TARDIS, he's just obnoxious.
But I put that down again to
Saywood
and having to have these delaying tactics before we get to whatever, and it's another one of these bitch scenes. I don't think it's as bad as Varos, but it is like, okay, at this point in the season, we don't really need it anymore.
No, that's right.
It was actually even worse in the script.
Right.
There's a line in the script to the effect of, the Doctor says, while Perry's in the room but not directly to her, this girl vexes me so much I might as well kill myself.
Oh, well, I'm glad they didn't do that.
Well, it's Pennant Roberts, Colin Baker and Nicola Bryant just said, no, we're not doing this anymore. For me, there's only one bit of that scene that's really bad, and that's when he screams bad at her and she cringes.
Yeah.
You know, that's really horrible. The rest of it I don't mind so much, like when he's giving this description of this place and she's like, that's exactly what you say about the Ivor, right? And
he has a tap. That is funny.
And another thing I actually really love is the beginning of that padding scene where Perry's insisting on coming with him and they're actually showing genuine concern and affection for one another. And it's a really good balance for the characters because it's sort of the equivalent of that scene in The Hand of Fear where I worry about you, but I worry about you. But these two characters would never quite put it in those words. They're both a little bit too proud. So it turns into an argument.
But I agree with you. I do like that bit because you know the Doctor is concerned and wants her out of the TARDIS in case he doesn't come back. And I do like that bit of it. The thing that gets to me is the fact that episode one was overrunning by several minutes, and Pennant Roberts wanted to move the cliffhanger earlier. He felt there was a point and the rest of that stuff could go into episode two and there wouldn't be a problem. John Nathan Turner wouldn't have it.
Yeah, because the episode cliffhanger had to be the Doctor in peril. Where Pennant wanted to move it was Perry in peril. It was the scene where they're in the caves and she realises she's dropped the note and the guards burst in and shoot one of the rebels.
Yeah.
And Pennant said, look, I've got these shots. I can make it look like Perry's been shot. Like Tomb of the Cybermen, episode 3, where we don't know who's been shot. And it's like, actually, that would have worked. But instead, yeah, they had to cut stuff out of episode one to make it fit and then put this stuff into episode two. Even then, there was some stuff they managed to move out of episode one into episode two, like Perry being dragged along to the Morlocks. But that creates this kind of weird thing where she's dragged along and tied up near a Morlocks, and then she's dragged back to a cell, and then she's dragged back to the Morlocks again.
I hate that. I hate that she has a thing around her neck and she's being dragged along. I think that this story may be, apart from that scene in Twin Dilemma, might be the worst treatment that Perry receives. It's the second time this season where she's going to be transformed into something against her will. She's tied up and menaced by the least convincing alien threat since
Brontosaur penis head.
Yeah, it's awful. And it is like you joke about, you know, Brontosaur penis head, but it is phallic. It is, you know, a phallus dentatus. She is pathetic in her response to it. She just screams until a man comes along and rescues her. And kudos to Herbert, who I think is lovely and gets to have a hero moment there rescuing Perry. But it's just pathetic that Perry needs rescuing again. And the threat is she's going to be forced to breed with the Borad. So it's sexual, you know. And when she says, "Don't I get a say in this?" at the very end, and the doctor says, "No, of course not, shut up," which is meant to be a funny line, and Colin delivers it that way, it's just a little bit depressing that that's exactly the point.
And this is where the whole thing falls down, is because the moment she goes on the tour of the Citadel, she's just then this victim, right, which is so 1960s and should not be now in the 1980s. Yeah.
Mm. Even the 1960s didn't do it that much.
But the Borad's plan is insane. Like, he's not even going to breed with a person from his own planet, and it all comes down to the fact that this gas and the thing has to attack her at the... Like, there's no scientific reason or rhyme.
The doctor even calls him out on that. You know, he says that's hardly a scientific experiment. Where's your control?
Couldn't he clone a whole bunch of Borads as well, given that he has a few spares in his closet somewhere?
Do you know, every time I watch this story, I forget the terrific plot twist that he's cloned himself, right? I always forget. And then it's like, well, we've got 15 minutes to go. What's going to happen? Then suddenly it's a clone and I'm going... Every time I watch it, I forget.
Yeah, and is
with a different coloured eye as well?
I think the makeup on the Borad is good. Great.
And his performance is excellent.
His performance is great. And
voice.
And I love his little set thing, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, I do like that set. And I don't mind, not in the Time Lash set, which looks like, but that other big set, like, is quite good. But then all the other sets are just rubbish. But I like the Borad stuff, okay? I do like Paul Darrow at times. I think Colin gives a good performance in what is a terrible script. But when we're in the Time Lash room and the doctor has the crystal thing, okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he stands there and he turns it on, right? Now, surely it should then project him there. He should move away to the console. The Borad should then fire the laser to this projection. Then the doctor should move to the console and he should fire it there. So he's actually not in the beam. But the way it's shot is he's still standing as the beam goes through him. So he should technically drop dead. It's wrong.
We've had a 15-20 minute scene of him explaining how that thing works, and then
it doesn't work that
way. Directed incorrectly. He is shot with that beam. It's really bad.
I don't understand how the director could get it that wrong in that sequence.
It's really inept. I actually think that there is something slightly sweet about that, and that he has a gun that sends you back in time, and he has a magic time crystal that does things. And clearly the story was meant to be about a society that uses time as a weapon or something like that.
Yeah, in Glenn McCoy's original outline, there was a lot more about time. And also, his original outline was a Dalek story. The Daleks were going to be the Bandrels invading this planet, and it was going to be about the Carfelons fighting them off. And Eric Saywood said, "No, sorry, I'm writing the Dalek story." So that didn't happen.
Oh, the Bandrels. The Bandrels are coming. The glove puppets are coming. I love the Bandrels.
They are actually 30-foot tall cyborgs.
I love them, and I love all that stuff. And I also love, you may remember this, friends of the podcast, Simon Moore, Peter Griffiths, and I think Kate Orman, back many years ago when they were film students, did a re-edit of that, and Simon had a sock on his hand. So he does the whole Bandrel thing with this sock, and the final sequence was when it drops out of sight, reminds me of the Drashigs. I wish I had, I think I've got it on video. I need to dig it up, but it was just so funny. Like, I love the Bandrels. I think the, but in that padding scene, the Doctor could have explained something about using the crystal to deflect the, you know, just some bit of dialogue in there rather than what we get when he gets back and he says to Perry, oh, I'll tell you later. We get no explanation as to how that happens. And I just sit there going, if you're going to write a padding scene, give me some scientific, you know, mumbo jumbo. Give me something.
And there was, in the script, there was a techno-babble explanation. It still didn't make any sense, but there's no reason to cut it. I mean, Colin Baker was not John Pertwee. Colin Baker could do techno-babble, for God's sake.
Speaking of which, this is the other thing that gets to me with this story, is the fact that we have to then have this continuity thing where it's referencing a previous adventure that the Pertwee Doctor has gone on, which no one has ever seen. Like, you know, I'm sure when they pitched this, they might have thought, oh, fans will get something out of this. Ooh, it's an adventure we've never seen. But to the general public, they'd be going like, well, you know, it's an alienating thing. Yeah. It's another continuity thing. Mm. And the fact that then Perry has to be versed in having like a, who Joe Grant is, and we have to have the locket with Joe. And then it seems at one moment there's one companion, but in the dialogue it's like, oh, there's only one of you this time, so there must have been somebody else. But,
like Yates.
Well, that's the only one that could be, you know.
I think Paul Cornell retconned that in Speed of Flight. I think that was written by Paul Cornell. And at the end, sort of, that's Mike Yates going off and having an adventure with the Doctor and Joe. And at the end, they're heading to Carfell in the epilogue.
Oh, wow. But, you know, as a kid, I kind of liked, you know, the shattering of the mirror wall or whatever it is and the picture of them. Like, I liked that, like, as a little nerd fanboy. But I think it's just... It robs the story of them having to prove who they are to the rebels or to whoever's trying to overthrow. And I just don't like that in Doctor Who where it's some person we've met before. Like, it's just a like shorthand. Disaster. It's just a shorthand to get into it without really having a payoff.
Yeah. There's a real problem we've said before about continuity in this era. And I've said that when they do it, they get it wrong, like last week. And now here we have just completely invented continuity. And, you know, if having continuity references has any value at all, and you know, the new series has shown that it does, is that you get a flicker of recognition from longtime fans. You know, I love the recreation of the first Doctor's TARDIS console room towards the end of Series 9. I thought that stuff was really great. But here, now we're inventing continuity and putting it in, and it's hard to know what possible reason we could have it. Mm. And I think it is because Glenn McCoy has got the idea that that's the sort of thing that Doctor Who does.
Yeah. I remember... years ago, when Doctor Who magazine started doing their special editions that they do three of a year, their first run was special editions based on the Doctors. So there was the complete Sixth Doctor. And the foreword, I believe, was written by Gareth Roberts. And he has a wonderful line in that where he says, in this era of the show, the Doctor becomes the show's fetishistic raison d'etre. Mm. And if you look at this past season and The Twin Dilemma, Vengeance on Varos is the only story where people don't know who Time Lords are.
Yeah. That's boring, isn't it?
Yeah.
I hate the constant references to regeneration that we get throughout this year. You know, it just reminds us that Colin never gets to be the Doctor. He's always the Sixth Doctor. And even that terrible, terrible nickname for him that you used the other day in chat.
What, Sixy?
Yeah, don't ever say that in my presence again. acknowledges the fact that he's just one of many Doctors, and the references to regeneration do that as well. And I hate it.
Yeah. I mean... the bit with the Borad referring to his ability to regenerate, like that won't save you. That was put in, you know, because fans might object, but I think it's something that takes you out of the moment.
It's kind of like at every episode ending and every time the Doctor's under threat, we have to shoehorn some dialogue in explaining, yes, we're aware that the Doctor regenerates, mm-hmm. you know, like, do we have to do that?
Yeah, no.
The show got on for like 14, 15, 16 years without it. Mm.
And, you know, we've got the continuity of the Doctor having met the Borad when he was a scientist, some sort of past history that, you know, really in the end means nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be an interesting touch if we didn't do it so often already. Like, you know, in recent stories we've had Asmael, we've had the cyber controller who we're meant to believe, at least in mind, is the same cyber controller as the Doctor had previously met. We've had the Master and the Rani. We've had Destari, who's an old friend of the Doctor's. In a way, it's a bit more valid in the story because this story needs a bit more depth. But as you say, it doesn't mean much in the end. You know, it's just this line of, yes, we've met before, Doctor. And it's like, well, so bloody what?
Mm. You know, I really think if they'd done a complete edit of this whole thing, like as a 45-minute or 50-minute episode and really cut it down.
A 10-minute Children in Need episode.
Well, yes, that's extreme. Like, you know, the edit that I was talking about earlier, but then going through part two and just really just it's the Borat and it's the
missile
coming and just leave it at that and really cut it back, you might have something that's acceptable and ditch a lot of this other continuity stuff. I mean, all the stuff with the rebels and the Felch and rocks and that sort of thing is just like...
No, boring.
Like, who cares?
You know, there is one thing this story gets right that rarely gets done right in this era, and that's letting the Doctor solve the problem. So the Doctor does something clever. He tricks the Borad into shooting himself with his own laser, so he defeats him without, you know, just gunning him in the face. Then he sacrifices himself to save them from the oncoming missile. You know, he does have a proper role in resolving the story. The oncoming missile, though, is absolutely ruined by the fact that there is that 10-minute padding scene in the middle of it that robs it of any urgency whatsoever. So the missile's coming, but we have time to bitch and talk in the TARDIS for ages and ages.
Yeah, but I find that scene so charming. You know, it's almost the opposite of that 7-minute scene I mentioned last week in Destari's office, which had a few moments of charm, but just feels like it should have been interspersed with other things, whereas having this almost in real time with just one cutaway back there, it lets... George Chandler as Herbert shine a little bit more as well, because he goes from being all gung-ho and, oh, we're going to save the world, to, oh, I didn't realise we were going to die.
I sit between you two. Like, I mean, I know it's padding. There's parts of it that I like and there's other parts where I'm going to go, like, give me more, give me explanations, that sort of thing.
I think it just robs the story of pace at a time when it really needs it, because that's a really dramatic bit. There's no music either. I think the music here is extremely inept, but there's no music there to help sell it. You know, like, we're all in terrible danger, but it's all word peril. We just have the Bandrels telling us they've sent a missile. We have a lot of standing around in the TARDIS talking about this terrible missile.
Yeah.
All of that.
We only have the budget for one Bandrel ship, so the other two ships of the fleet are represented by little green asterisks. The music is by Elizabeth Parker, who, unless I'm very much mistaken, is Doctor Who's first female incidental music composer. I know we've had like the Delian mode in Inferno, but that wasn't written specifically for it. And I think she may remain to date Doctor Who's only female music composer.
And she's not back again, is she, ever?
No. But she had done a lot of work on Blake 7.
Yeah, in fact, there's only one episode of Blake 7 that isn't scored by Dudley Simpson, and that's the episode that Dougie Camfield directs called Duel in Season 1. And, of course, Dougie Camfield wouldn't have anything to do with Dudley Simpson, and so Elizabeth Parker does do the incidental music on that.
Ah, right, just the one episode then.
Yeah, but she did do sound and stuff, I think.
Ah, right. Yeah.
I have to say, I do like the fact that the Doctor and Perry are pleased to see each other at the end. It's really nice, you know. It's a nice moment. Now, can you tell me what the fake cliffhangers are for episode 1 and 3 in the Australian edits? Is it, it appears the Doctor is making a return visit, or have I got that wrong?
I thought it was just before that. I thought it was, and don't go wandering off, yes, sir.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
And what about in episode 3? Is it Perry versus the Morlocks? Is that a cliffhanger?
Yes. So that at least feels like a proper cliffhanger. And it kind of has her scream leading into the cliffhanger.
Right.
And the actual cliffhanger in the middle
is the Doctor going into the time lash.
Goodbye, really. Doctor, unpleasant journey, with a close-up on Colin's face.
Doing that tongue thing.
Yeah. Colin in pain is never good.
Into the time lash.
And we get a crash zoom on the time lash as well.
Oh, can I just say another continuity thing? Yeah. Another continuity thing, right? So the time lash, like, the Doctor suffers the terrible threat that he might end up in 12th century Scotland or something, you know, and we already kind of know that. At the end, the Borad goes through the timeline, which he should do, and ends up as the Loch Ness Monster.
Lovely.
Because we've never had a Doctor Who story that explains the Loch Ness Monster before.
It's fantastic. So
not only do we have three Atlantises, we now have two Loch Ness Monsters.
It's Doctor Who. It's imperfect. I laugh at that.
Okay, I agree.
But it's something that you think that they would...
They care about that in this era. So why are they doing that? Where's Ian Levine? Is he on holiday?
Fans pointed that out, and John Nathan Turner's response was exactly what you just said. Well, there's two of them now.
Right. Lovely. Lovely.
Something this story comes in for criticism of, I don't think I've said this explicitly, but yeah, I quite enjoy this one. I enjoy it more than the two Doctors. But something this story comes into criticism of is the Doctor's dispatching of the second Borad.
Well, in a sense, I don't mind that. And there is something fairy tale about him being defeated by the side of a mirror. Mm. And it really, you know, the story is leading up to it. It's laid in the mirror thing. It's deliberately designed sets that look incredibly boring and dull, as Perry points out, because of the mirror thing and his anxiety about how he looks. And so, like, I've already talked about the awful dialogue between the Doctor and Perry, and the fact that once again Perry's going to be forcibly bred with, and all of that's awful. But, you know, like, I think that having him shrinking away from the mirror is fine. I think there's no way that he can't end up being pushed in the time lash. You know, the narrative just is heading towards that.
Yeah, I mean, some people have said he's bullying the Borad based on his looks, and I watched this story in a new light this time based on current political events. Tekka is Trump because Tekka has no idea how to do his job, so he just makes grandiose claims and calls up their nearby allies and says, no, we're not going to give you any grain. Sure, what are you going to do, bomb us? Kind of thing. Whereas...
Okay. So who's the Borat?
Well, that's the thing. I was looking at...
Steve Bannon.
I was looking at that scene going... People always say, is it all right for the Doctor to throw the Borad in the time lash? And another part of my brain just said, is it all right to punch a Nazi in the face? And it's like, well, you know what? It's always all right for the Doctor to throw a dictator down a pit.
Yeah, yeah.
And we might look at that and go, well, the Doctor shouldn't be violent. Well, what else is he going to do in that situation? We keep coming back to this with Colin, and it's a way it didn't quite happen with Peter. I know you kind of raised, Nathan, that... For instance, in Resurrection of the Daleks, it's a situation the Doctor shouldn't be put in. Whereas in these situations where Colin has to attack Cybermen or Shockeye or the Borad, it feels like more of a natural progression than the Doctor saying, I have to go kill Davros. Well, yeah, it's a situation he has to react to, which in itself is a problem, which the next script editor will seek to redress, that the Doctor is a reactionary character now.
I think that pushing the Borad isn't really particularly violent, and it's more like tripping Eldrad with your scarf, you know.
Yeah.
It's very different from sort of gunning someone in the face, I think, and even different from poisoning Shockeye last week. I think it's hard to object to.
One of the puzzling things in this story for me as a kid was the robot and the fact that the burning one gets sent back in time. And
actually, I quite like that.
I think it's good. Like, I like it now, but I never understood as a kid that there were actually different ones. I just thought it was the same one.
Yes. Yeah.
And so it always confused me. And dear listeners, this was the first time I actually worked it out that it was actually a different robot. The first time.
Bessie doesn't say very much, does she?
No, she doesn't. Oh, dear. Okay, ratings. I just want to... take a moment.
Mm. I'd like to apologise to the millions of people who saw this on first transmission.
Well, believe it or not, episode one got 6.7 million, so 200,000 less people than the previous week decided not to tune in. But that did put it at 69th on the chart for the week, which is, you know, still above Attack of the Cybermen part one, which got 8.9 million. So episode two then jumps up to 7.4, which I think is the weaker episode of the two by far.
Yeah.
But it falls 10 places on the chart to 79th. So again, as I said previously, what's going on? Like, everything's all over the place. But suddenly, since the cancellation, which was at 6 million, we're now back to 7.4 million. So interesting. Bit of a rise, but for the completely the wrong episode. Maybe they liked episode one. You know these things, like an episode, people tune in, and then episode two is a train wreck. Yeah.
there are still things I like in episode two, though, that we haven't talked about. Like, I actually really like the bit where they lock themselves up in the Time Lash room. As a kid, I loved the journey inside the Time Lash. That felt dynamic and exciting to me as a child. I look at it now, and yes, I can see the bloody gaffer tape holding on the stanchions, and I know that Colin was being slowly emasculated by a Kirby harness.
They're all kind of rubbing themselves in a suggestive way up and down these sort of polystyrene crystals. You remember when the John Nathan Turner era was really visually inventive?
Yeah.
Remember we would get Peter Grimwade in and do something really remarkable with the way the show looked? This looks vastly worse than the show did back when Graham Williams had no money.
Yeah. I think what's really coming back to bite John Nathan Turner is his reluctance to use people with more experience than himself.
Yeah.
And, you know, slowly we've seen he's escalated a disagreement with Peter Grimwade into him never directing for the show again.
And then never writing for the show again.
Yeah, well, and even then when he did write one more script, it was only because Eric Saywood went behind J&T's back.
Yeah.
You know, we've lost Lovett, Bickford and Paul Joyce, who were the best directors of his first season, but it was just kind of like, well, no, they've taken too much time. It's like, rather than work with them, they were just never invited back again. And instead we get Ron Jones and Peter Moffat keep getting work, and Pennant Roberts, who is not necessarily a bad director, but by this point is incredibly lackluster. You know, I think the only story he's really put in an amazing amount of work visually was The Face of Evil. He's another one who's an actor's director, but, you know, you look at The Sunmakers, you look at Warriors of the Deep, he doesn't really care that much about set design so long as he's got a set to shoot.
But what you've got here in this season is, I think every other story for me in this season has I think, interesting sets and good location work, and there's colour and there's theatrics, and I like every other one.
Yeah.
This one, it's sort of like, okay, we spent our money on everything else, and the thing coming up, there is no money, right? We've only got these big sets that we can't do much with. Pennant, again, as you were saying, like he's casting people who just aren't delivering performances.
No.
Yeah.
And that combined with the script, I'm going back to what you said at the beginning, all these things mount up. I don't mind Colin's coat in this because it's very colourful compared to everything else. And it's not on Earth, so it tends to work. I've spent a lot of this podcast criticizing a lot of elements, but I will say this, that when I actually did watch it, I actually enjoyed large chunks of it. And then there are other things that I just think need to be edited out. Like 35 minutes of this needs to be edited out, and all the Perry stuff needs to be edited out. And it just needs, you know, to make something that's better. Mm. I don't particularly hate it, but there are just all of these problems. But I've defended John Nathan Turner's ability to handle money and get things done. But in this case, that is not the case.
Mm.
Is he just tired? Why would you as the producer allow this to be as visually a train wreck as it is?
Yeah. Look, I think he's learned something from the previous year, at least, where their big blockbuster story is at least the last story of this season instead of the second last one.
Okay.
And, you know, we were mystified by just the horrific cheapness of The Twin Dilemma.
Mm.
Now we've got horrific cheapness, but at least it's not being done at the end of the season.
So it's hidden in the second last story.
This is the Doctor Who equivalent of what they will come to call on Star Trek a bottle show.
Mm.
So there were scripts written for Star Trek The Next Generation, which is now only 2 years away. As we talk about the story, there were scripts written for that which were specifically designed to use standing sets and maybe one planet set. Now, very often what they would do for those shows is they would do something character-based, something philosophical. A very good early one is called Where Silence Has Lease, where they're at the mercy of this intelligence which is testing and trialing them. I know not everyone considers it to be brilliant.
Thing with a cat face, is it?
Yeah, Nagilo.
God, Brenda.
But the thing is, Doctor Who could have done something like that for once. It could have done a whole story set in the TARDIS, which we hadn't had for a while. You can still have guest actors and you can make it interesting and trippy. But instead, they do this 1960s story. If you look at this like a 1960s story, I think you enjoy it a lot more. But as you said earlier, Nathan, there's no excuse for why we're doing a 1960s story.
The corridors outside of the Borad and that main time lash set are lamentable. Mm. And all of the caves are just useless. Yeah. And that the caves needed 2 days of location work on caves to try and lift it. You know, yeah. But you might remember back in the dawn of time when we were doing Planet of the Daleks, and all of a sudden they're outdoors for one sequence
for the ice cano
or something like that, and it just breaks that, you know. Yeah. And this script needed to be written so that you could film it indoors completely, and that is not the case.
I think if we're going to the 60s, I think the nearest analog for this is probably the Savages. And I think the Savages as a story is absolutely superior to this in every possible respect.
It had a message.
Yeah, it actually had a proper political message, and this lacked that. It had memorable characters. It even had a little sort of character arc for Stephen, but it was just so much better done. And I think by now we've had all of these elements so many times, our expectations that the program will be inventive and will say something worth saying, our expectations that that will happen have virtually evaporated by now. And I think that we're trudging towards the end of the program, and something needs to happen to the creative team to save it from disaster.
Yeah, I feel like this tries to have a message about detente with the whole there's a nuclear missile coming and it's going to wipe us out. But there's perhaps one flicker of that in one scene.
It's so thin.
You know, yeah, exactly.
Not firing missiles at people is good. Not having missiles fired at you is good.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are important messages that we can take from Time Lash.
You know, that's something the script could have been hinged around, and we could have, the rebels are just rebelling because they're rebels. If the rebels had been rebelling because we know we're on the brink of war and we could be annihilated and we must find a way to make peace, all of a sudden you have a story arc.
Yeah.
And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to come up with that idea.
Why are they rebelling?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, were there other scripts sitting in Eric Saywood's desk at the time that were better than this that could have been made?
Yes.
With some editing. Now, I know Big Finish have done a season of missing episodes.
But I think Song of the Mangaptra was there. I think there was
Song of the Space Whale,
which is
Song of the Mangaptra, and Leviathan, which is another one. I don't want to go into too much detail of this because I think we're going to do a podcast on the missing season coming up. But there are scripts there. Now, whether because of budget, like they're too expensive.
Yeah.
But then to say we're still going to go ahead with this.
Yeah.
Look, I don't hate the whole thing. I can actually honestly sit down and watch this, unlike other Davisons that I never want to watch again. I would sit down and watch this and I can laugh with it and laugh at it, but there are bits where I have to fast forward, right? Yeah, it's not the worst of the worst for me, but it's very cheap on every level.
Dear listeners, we're departing the planet Carfel, and unlike the Doctor in this story, we're actually going to go rescue all those poor buggers who were in 12th century Scotland. But do come back next week as we wrap up this season with Revelation of the Daleks. Until then, you can find us online at flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we either will shortly be starting or have just started the lengthy Timothy Dalton era of Bond films, and you can find all preceding Bond films there as well. Bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, Bondfingercast on Twitter. Don't forget, you can vote for your choice of Pertwee commentary. The choices are Spearhead from Space, The Mutants, The Three Doctors, and Death to the Daleks. And also, we have our upcoming Colin Baker Big Finish special episode, so try to get yourselves some copies of Jubilee, The One Doctor, Doctor Who, and The Pirates, and Criss Cross. Until next week, may none of your androids be confusingly played by the same actor. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you at the Falchion Rock.
That was Fly Through Entirety, starring Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley and Brendan Jones. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Planet Zog, was recorded on the 11th of February 2017. The next episode will be released on the 5th of March. Nearing retirement age, why not start a new life on the planet Carfel? It's a beautiful place, and its complete lack of reflective surfaces means that you won't even realise when you start to really let yourself go.
I think that's probably it.
Yeah, that's good. I'm actually just looking up missing stories from season 22. We could have had the first Sontarans.
But they wouldn't have done that because they've just had the Sontarans.
Yeah. And there's one by... Isn't there one by J.P. Hammond or something?
That's next season. Oh, okay. We could have had the Guardians of Prophecy, which Big it's Finish make.
Terrible.
The Johnny Byrne one?
That's awful.
Hexagora. Well, what became Hexagora?
There just must have been...
League of the Ten
other
Threads.
Scripts must have been too expensive to make. That's all I can say.
I actually think it's probably that thing about not hiring, like... Nathan Turner's reluctance to hire good writers because he was threatened by them.
Threatened by them. Rather, you know, it's like we need new people.
Yeah, the whole thing's gone horribly toxic.
And we've criticised Eric Saywood a lot, but I think, you know, I mean, I love this season. Like, I've said it 1,000 times. I still love it. Yeah. I love it. Flaws and all. I think Doctor Who is imperfect, and I feed off the imperfections in this. But the decisions that John Nathan Turner is making now at this point are not benefiting the show.
Yeah.
They're benefiting him.
Yeah.
And that is the one criticism I will now have of him.
Yeah. Except, you know, when he's working with Bidmead and when he's working with Cartmell, so there's something about the relationship between the two of them that's the problem. Mm.
But he's in this corner now where it's like, you know, although he's wanting to get out, if he does, the show's gone.
Yeah.
Mm.
We could have had a story written by Ian Marta.
Oh,
called Volvok.
I would totally have been up for that.
I think we should wrap this one up.
Yeah, definitely. Okay.